Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. It's so easy to get caught up in the drama and the distractions of daily life that most of us miss a lot as we rush through our day. And I can attest to that today. I've had the most stressful morning, and I'll tell you, I got to get out of my head here and let my guest help me straighten things out, because it's a mess in there. In this episode of Pathways, we're going to be visiting with the author of a very fun book that offers easily digestible ways for us to better understand our inner life. And this is Arthur Delhenne, author of the new book, Get Out of Your Head, It's a Mess in There, 101 Simple Aphorisms for Thinking and Living. Now, after graduating with distinction from the University of Wisconsin with a degree in communications, Art Delhenne headed west to pursue his TV career, settling in Hollywood, where he has directed over 300 primetime episodes and 15 pilots, including such things as Punky Brewster, Head of the Class, Silver Spoons, Webster, and Sister Sister. His experience navigating the entertainment industry and 2 years of study at the Coaches Training Institute prepared Art to transition to his next career as a certified career coach and establishing Los Angeles Coaching in 2000. Well, hello, Art, and welcome to the Pathways Show.
Thanks, Paul.
I hope you can help
thanks
me
for
out
having
today.
Me. Yeah, I'm happy to do my best, you know.
Okay, I'm going to take whatever I can get. So let's start by talking about what prompted you to collect and publish a book of aphorisms with commentary.
I'm dyslexic, Paul. I've been dyslexic since the very beginning, and reading's always been difficult for me. And aphorisms and slogans and sayings always appealed to me because they were so short and sticky, and I could remember them. Like, look before you leap. I mean, you could write a whole book about that in life. And, those short aphorisms have always stuck with me, and they've been my guides. And for me, they're like our cave paintings. You know, they talk about this sort of embedded knowledge that's in our cultural evolution. And each one to me is a kind of mini miracle. And I started collecting them. I think I have 100 pages of them now. And then when the pandemic hit, and I knew I was going to be stuck in my house apartment for the next year and a half or two, I thought, well, what am I going to do with these? And I decided to share them with everybody and write a book.
Uh-huh. So, and did that help you get through the pandemic?
Oh, gosh, yes. It was like, you know, there's nothing like teaching something to learn the subject. And the same, I think, is about writing. There's nothing like writing about something to really understand the subject. So I had collected all these aphorisms, but to really sit down with each one and sort of drill down and understand how it affected my life, how it served my life, how it helped me to, you know, recover my own equilibrium when my thinking was, you know, off the charts, just help me. So, you know, I wrote about how to stay sane during the pandemic. And in doing so, I managed to stay, you know, relatively sane.
Okay. And was it, what was your process? Was it difficult to choose 101 aphorisms out of the thousands that you've come across in your life?
It wasn't hard. It took time, but what I did was just started at the top, and I said, and I went through and I just put a red dot next to the ones that I liked the most and it had the most impact on my life. And then I took took those, there were probably 200 or 250, and I moved them to another list, and then I reduced that list. Okay, that one, yeah, but that one's like this one, and that one's like, so I just kept reducing and reducing and reducing until I got 101. And then I thought, well, I can't just drop 101 aphorisms. I got to put them in some order. They've got to make some sense chronologically. So I decided to group them in like groups. And in my index, for instance, I grouped them under necessary stuff, like thinking, talking, listening, action, and achievement, and then challenging stuff. I mean, this is the stuff that's tough, right? Ego, control, attachment, judgment, blame, resentment, fear, pain, worry. And then I shifted to inevitable stuff, which is past, present, and future. Then good stuff, relationships and forgiveness, humility and acceptance, then the sweet stuff, spirit and awareness, understanding and gratitude. So I took them all and I put them under those headings. And then the book, once I was able to do that, the book was boom, the book was there. And then I started writing. Actually, I'd been writing before that, but it hadn't been organized in any logical way.
And how do you envision people using this material? What do you recommend? You know, so I mean, let's say they read the whole book, which I did, and I really enjoyed it and got a lot out of it. And I love your personal reflections and the sharing of your experiences as they relate to these aphorisms. But before we go there, let's define what is an aphorism. There's a quote in your book: an aphorism is a pithy observation that contains a general truth, wisdom, or advice. Or maybe I got that from Wikipedia. I'm not sure. But
Either one works.
So, okay. So how? And then this is a quote from your book: an aphorism is like a sauce that has been reduced. Unnecessary words evaporated, leaving behind a brief, well-honed concept reduced to its essence. So, I mean, everybody, you know, can relate to these, you know, a stitch in nine saves nine, et cetera. But how do you suggest people, they've read your whole book and they've gone through it and you've grouped them. And after that, I mean, should they highlight the ones that are most meaningful to them, or how do they, is there an ongoing way that they can use the material?
Well, some would contend that it's a great bathroom book. So,
I see.
Of course, okay. You can have it in your bathroom and open it up and read a couple aphorisms and enjoy them, mm-hmm. and walk away. Most people in the reviews and what I've heard in feedback was that some people have read the book all the way through at one or two sittings and feel that they missed a lot. And most people say that they're keeping it on their bedside table or their bathroom or on their coffee table, and that they just open it at random and read sections of it. Or some people have gone through it systematically, reading two or three aphorisms a day and sort of bringing those into their life for the day. And then the next day doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And each aphorism has an accompanying illustration or cartoon. So right. Like, for instance, this one, what you think about expands, right? That's from Wayne Dyer. And if you can see, the little man there is saying, even snails, you know, so each one has its own cartoon. So you can have enjoy that. And then at the end of each aphorism, there's a question. And here the question is, what do you notice when you stop ruminating about a problem? And a lot of people have said that they use that for journaling, that it's their journaling exercise for the day, and it helps bring the aphorism into clear focus for them. Okay. And you can just read the book for enjoyment any way you gosh darn want to read it.
Now, it seems to me that in the part of the process of writing this book, or just collecting aphorisms in general, is having an understanding of what an aphorism is. And you know, I think you must be quite a scholar on the subject of aphorisms. And I'm wondering, how does an expression become an aphorism?
You know how on the beach, a rocky beach, with lots of little pebbles and rocks, how they're all just worn down and they're just beautiful and smooth. You know, that's what I think happens with our language, is over time, all of the unnecessary words are extracted. Or a writer in his or her process hones the words to try to get it to mean exactly what he or she wants it to mean, so that it's sticky and sticks with you and is witty and has some charm and has some panache, you know, so that it sticks with you. And I think that's how they come to be. And as I said, they're embedded in our evolutionary process. And I just find them little miracles, because I can say an aphorism to myself. Like, let's take one in here. I'll just open the book at random. Expectations are resentments under construction.
Oh,
and
I never heard that one before I read your book.
And that came from Anne Lamott, you know, a wonderful writer
So what was that again? Can you repeat that one again?
Of course. Expectations are resentments under construction.
Wow. That's so good.
Right. Okay. So that speaks to so much of my life experience. You know, I had expectations so that my father would be a certain way. He wasn't. I had expectations that my marriage would be a certain way. It wasn't. I had expectations that my son would survive his mental illness and addiction. He didn't. I have expectations that the sun will come up in the morning and go down at night. Okay. I don't have a resentment about that, because it usually happens. But everything else in life, you know, I have an expectation that I'll be able to solve your problems for you today because you've had a challenging day. The truth is, you know, if I can't, or if you resist or resent that I'm doing that for you, then I'm holding a resentment for you for not listening to what I have to say. I mean, it just becomes this circle. And it's, you know, when I always read this to myself when I'm thinking about, you know, am I going to jump into somebody else's business? Another of my favorite is, there are two kinds of business, my business and none of my business. Mm. So if I stay on my side of the street, if I stick with my business, then it's pretty hard to have resentments against others, because I'm not meddling in their business. And I don't have expectations that they'll be a certain way that I want them to be.
And why do you consider them miraculous? You call them mini miracles. A miracle.
I think because they're so condensed, mm-hmm. and they're so perfect. You know, two or three words can say something so important about our day-to-day life.
Right.
And can be sticky enough that we remember it. That's why I think they're miracles. And I love words. You're a writer. You play with words. I love the play of the words, right. The way they play with each other, and then the way they play with my mind. And the fact that they're so clever and witty and deep at the same time. So the levels of understanding just keep getting deeper and deeper and deeper as I think about them more and more and more.
And so they,
you
have
know, they're like, go ahead. Sorry.
They have an amazing transformational impact, especially for their size.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, thank you. Perfect. Exactly.
Now, you mentioned your son, and I know from reading the book that you lost your son while writing this book.
Yes.
How was that for you? And what's the relationship between, what did the writing the book do for you, and how is it related to your son's passing?
The book saved my life. It not only saved me from the pandemic, but it saved me, maybe that's a slight overstatement. It was a place for me to go to find solace. The book was a place for me to, I could grieve, and then, you know, when the grief passed for a moment, I could go back to the book. I always had some place to go other than grief. And the grief was so overwhelming and so painful that at times I thought, you know, I couldn't bear it anymore. But it was like I had this friend in my computer that I could go to, and this friend would help me get back on track in my mind. This friend would help me be productive again. This friend would, you know, allow me to express my feelings, a lot of which I did express, some of which I expressed in other forms. You know, I'd be writing an aphorism for the book, and all of a sudden I'd be writing a poem about hearing my son knock on the door in the middle of the night, and how I woke up and ran to the door thinking, oh, he's back. And I'd throw the door open and look left and right, and he wouldn't be there. And I'd say, how could I have heard his knock so clearly and he not be there ever again?
Right.
And so I wrote a lot of poetry. I wrote my grief.
Right. So it helped you in the grieving process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there isn't much about that in the book, because the book's not about that.
Right.
It'll be in another book somewhere, and I'm sure it's in 100 books written by parents who have lost a child. It's in their books already.
Yeah, grieving is such an important healing thing, and it's something that we're not well trained in, I don't know that people handle it very well in general. You know, it's an interesting phenomenon, and I'm sorry about your son and his passing, but anyway, thank you for sharing that.
I did write about one thing about it, and I can't remember the aphorism offhand or where it is in the book, but I can paraphrase it. It's like, what I realized in my grief is that grief is the other side of love.
Right.
That I always thought, you know, grief and love were opposites for some strange reason. I don't know why. And then I started writing about it, and I realized, oh, wow, I still love my son as much now as I did when he was alive. And I'll love him still forever. So, and in this grief, I was able to see that this was really a logical part of life. And it made so much sense to me. And it really made grieving a much more wonderful thing to do. It helped me understand grief and allowed me to do it in a way that connected me with my son in ways that weren't negative, but ways that were positive and helpful.
Yeah. I mean, usually when we think about love, we're thinking in terms of attachment, and we're feeling the attachment to somebody or something. And grieving as a form of love is not something that we're inclined towards in our society, because it's about loss, you know, and it's, I think it's something we're going to learn, or hopefully we're going to learn, or else we're going to suffer a lot more, or possibly commit suicide. It's like, it's a tricky thing. And it's beautiful, the fact that you're sharing that. And I hope you do write something more about that.
Thank you.
Okay, so I want to ask you about beliefs, because you have some stuff about beliefs that I found very interesting. You say a belief is a thought you married. Now,
right.
I'm not sure this is a critique of beliefs or a critique of marriage, or possibly a critique of both.
Okay.
I can't see that clearly. What's that one say?
Okay. It says, a belief is a thought you married. And then the bride is saying, I've wasted my life. I'll die alone. I'm too old. I'm stupid. I'm ugly. Happily ever after.
Oh God. Oh, that is so true. And I'm very interested in this topic of beliefs, because we're so hamstrung by our beliefs. And I think what you say, and I'm going to quote your book, is that beliefs are a way of sustaining our identity, even when they are flawed or cause harm to others or ourselves. They may be a misguided way to fathom the unfathomable. We don't understand something, so we insert a belief instead. Wow, that is so true. You know, the addiction to being right, or thinking that you're right, is so powerful. It's really leads to a lot of problems. And
we can see it in our, you know, our discourse today. Is everybody believes things so strongly that they refuse to even entertain the possibility of something other than that belief. And yeah. Basically what those beliefs do is they separate us instead of binding us together.
Right.
And I've lived my whole life with a negative inner dialogue that made me believe that I was stupid, that I was fat, that, you know, I couldn't climb the rope in gym, that I'd never succeeded anything. I mean, I don't know where this voice came from, but it was torturous. And these beliefs just plagued me and terrorized me my whole life, until I finally realized, hey, wait a second. Those are just electronic, you know, impulses.
Synapses,
thank you, in my brain, you know, downloading these fragments of ideas onto my hard drive and messing me up. And once I understood that, I decided to leave them alone and not dwell on them and go on about my business. And once I did that, life was a heck of a lot more pleasant.
Yeah. Yeah. We have this inner critic. I think everybody has it. And it's so inexorable. It just never quits. And it's really good to know that and to be able to spot it in action. One of the beliefs that you talk about in the ego control and attachment section of your book, which I found very profound, and this one goes, if you think you're the smartest one in the room, you're in the wrong room. I thought that was really a good one. That's a good thing to remember. And, you know, and maybe worry creates an illusion of control. That's another thing that you say. If you worry enough about something, you might be able to find a solution before that future arrives. Yeah, I don't think it helps that much. But
No, it doesn't. But I've got an Amazon warehouse full of worry. You know, it's full to the top, the rafters, you know, and it's like the warehouse takes up, I don't know, 10 square acres, you know, and it's full. It's absolutely full. And everything that's in that warehouse is not worth a plug nickel.
Right.
And never did me any good.
Mm-hmm. How does this book tie into your vocation as a career coach, your current vocation?
I use these aphorisms all the time when I'm coaching, because, you know, a client and I might be discussing some issue and we're chatting about it and talking about it and, you know, sort of tearing it apart and putting it back together and everything. And then I'll recall an aphorism that describes this whole thing we've been talking about for 30 minutes. And I'll just drop that aphorism in the session. And it's like, oh, right. That's it. And it's been around forever. You know, why can't I see that? When I was working with my coach and or therapist, you know, it was like, you only get it when you get it. You know, you only get it when,
right,
that when the time is right for you to get it. And sometimes the aphorism can help you get it quicker.
You know, we've just about run out of time, and I want to offer you the opportunity, if you would, to give our listeners one last piece of wisdom or advice.
Well, I'm not much of an advice giver, but I want to share my favorite aphorism.
Oh, great.
It's on page 185 of the book, and it's called "The Best I Will Ever Be Is Human."
Human.
The best I will ever be is human.
Wow. And what does that mean?
And, well, it means that every time I make a mistake, which I do daily, you know, every time I get a parking ticket, every time something comes out of my mouth that shouldn't, you know, every time I bump into the screen going out to my deck because I think it's open, you know, I say to myself, you know, I'm just human. I'm just human. And it allows me to laugh at myself. It allows me to let me know that I don't have to be perfect. It allows me to take an inventory of myself in that moment. And if I've done something that has hurt someone else or made them uncomfortable, you know, I can say, I can make an amends. I can say
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. You know, it kind of reminds me of the one, sometimes you got to laugh to keep from crying. And humanity evokes that one for me. Well, you know, there's so much more we could explore, but we have run out of time. And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website, which is Los Angeles Coaching, all one word, losangelescoaching.com. Thank you, Art. Thanks for being on the show. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Paul.
And for those of you listeners who may have tuned into Pathways late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Intuitive Intelligence, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. Now, don't worry, even if you tuned in late, you can play and or share this entire interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast. And I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with Arthur Delhan, the author of Get Out of Your Head, It's a Mess in There, 101 Simple Aphorisms for Thinking and Living. And there's Art showing the cover of the book. And I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed on the internet at www.kboo.fm. We are produced every Sunday morning by Donald Altman or myself at 8:30 USA Pacific Time. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in, and even better, listening to our podcast, which you can find for free at divination.com, divination.com, as well as via iTunes, my YouTube channel, and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and Podcasts, and thanks again to Arthur Delhan and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.